So, as Pedro has mentioned, and in your bulletin, we are looking at 1 Peter chapter 2 today, verses 13 to 17. It's a short paragraph, so we trust we'll be able to finish it in good time, and you'll get to your lunch in good time today. We've entitled the message, Responding to Civil Authority and Relating to All. Now, you might say, well, that's an amazing last part of your title, Relating to All, but as we move through the passage, I'll explain why I chose to include that in the title this morning. Now, if we look back at the previous chapter 1 and chapter 2, that brings us up to this 13th verse, what Peter has done thus far, he has established the identity and the mission of the people of God in this world, especially from chapter 1, verse 13 on, to chapter 2, verse 12. He now takes up the first of several submission-authority relationships. And in this passage, of course, it is responding to civil authority. In other words, the relationship of us as citizens to those whom God has placed over us in the government, that is a submission-authority relationship. And in this passage, Peter actually gives us five commands. However, the first command in verse 13 occupies most of the paragraph, and it isn't until we get to verse 17 that we have the last four commands. Bang, 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 bang. They're very short, very quick. But the first command occupies most of the paragraph. So the first command that we have in verse 1 is to be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution. Now the NIV, I'm using the ESV primarily, but the NIV reads, submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human authority. So you see, there's a difference in the translation of the word authority and institution. But what's behind it all is that this is authority which is properly instituted in the government that God puts in place in every country of the world. So it is an institution which is properly instituted and has authority under God to do its work. Now, this word, institution or authority, is in the Greek is found 19 times in the New Testament, and it usually means creation, creature, or created thing, as we see it used in the book of Romans, for example. But the context here makes it clear that it is not every human being in the world to whom we are to be subject. And meaning that the verb here, to be subject to, could not possibly bear in any case, since it refers here to subjection to an authority. That is the context here. So it is to subject ourselves to every institution or establishment of authority. Now, every human ordinance or authority or institution in the immediate context will include the citizen-civil government relationship, which we have in this passage. Then following this, which we'll look at tonight, is the servant-master relationship, where we're going to see how we as believers are to deal with injustice when masters wrongly handle or treat those who work for them, whether it's in the economic realm or in other realms. So that's the servant-master relationship. And then in chapter 3, we have the marriage relationship between husband and wife. So those are our three important relationships that Peter is going to deal with. And in our passage here, the word every means that this statement applies to all legitimate human authority structures. All legitimate human authority structures. Note also that there is an authority structure among sinless angels. For example, Michael is called the archangel. You would think an archangel has more authority than just a regular angel, wouldn't you? And he's called that in Jude chapter 9. Furthermore, an authority structure exists among the redeemed in heaven. How do we know that? Well, Jesus spoke of this in his parable of the 10 servants, each having received a mina, or some translations say a talent or a pound. Each had received a mina from the nobleman who was going into a far country to receive a kingdom and then to return. Listen as the servants report to their master when he returns, and I'm taking this now from Luke chapter 19. I'm going to read from verses 16 through 26. So if you want to turn to Luke 19, it's an extensive passage, but it will help us to understand the authority structures that Jesus spoke of in this parable among his servants, and especially as he referred to the future. So in Luke 19:16, the first came before him saying, "Lord, your mina has made 10 minas more." And he said to him, "Well done, good servant, because you have been faithful in a very little, you shall have authority over 10 cities." Okay? Authority over 10 cities. The second came saying, "Lord, your mina has made 5 minas." And he said to him, "And you are to be over 5 cities." So the degree of authority responsibility in the future depends on how we were using what was given to us here on earth. Then another came saying, "Lord, here is your mina, which I kept laid away in a handkerchief, for I was afraid of you, because you are a severe man. You take what you did not deposit and reap what you did not sow." He said to him, "I will condemn you with your own words, you wicked servant. You knew that I was a severe man, taking what I did not deposit and reaping what I did not sow." Well, he's putting the challenge now to this wicked servant. "Is that really what you knew about me? Why then did you not put my money in the bank, and at my coming I might have collected it with interest?" And he said to those who stood by, "Take the mina from him and give it to the one who has the 10 minas." And they said to him, "Lord, he has 10 minas. I tell you that to everyone who has, more will be given, but from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away." Notice how he called this man a wicked servant, right? He did not use what he had been entrusted with here on earth. Now, going to the next step, we learn that even among the persons of the Trinity, an authority structure exists for all eternity. Paul mentions this in two passages. The first is in 1 Corinthians 11:3, where Paul says, "But I want you to understand that the head of every man is Christ, the head of a wife is her husband, and the head of Christ is God." See, the head of Christ is God, an authority structure. And the second passage is in 1 Corinthians 15, verses 24 to 28. And this is that great chapter on the resurrection of the dead. "Then comes the end, when he delivers the kingdom to God, the Father, after destroying every rule and every authority and power. For he, that is Jesus, must reign until he has put all his enemies under his feet." Now, just stop for a moment. Do you believe this? Do you believe that right now Jesus is reigning over this entire universe until he puts every enemy under his feet, because that's in fact what is happening. And the last enemy to be destroyed is death. For God has put all things in subjection under his feet. But when it says all things are put in subjection, it is plain that he is excepted who put all things in subjection under him. In other words, God, who put everything in subjection under Christ, that is the Father, is accepted. He has not put himself under Christ, but everything else has been put under Christ. Verse 28, when all things are subjected to him, then the Son himself will also be subjected to him who put all things in subjection under him, that God may be all in all. So you see, in eternity, Christ will have this relationship with the Father where he himself will be subjected to him who put all things under him. So this issue of authority structures is very pervasive. We find it in all the relationships that we have just touched upon here. Now, coming back to our passage, to which authorities are we to submit in our passage? Well, first of all, Peter says we are to submit to every human institution or authority as established in the following governmental authorities. And, you know, in my notes I said compare Romans 13, 1-7, which Pedro had us read together, because it really ties in completely to what Peter is teaching. Paul and Peter are teaching the same thing. So, Peter goes on to say, whether it be to the king as supreme. I think the NIV as well as the ESV use the word emperor, whether it be to the emperor as supreme. The Greek is a word that's often translated king, so a lot of English translations will use king as supreme. So whether it's king or emperor, it's the supreme human authority that is over us in whatever country we are living. In this case, of course, it was the emperor in the Roman Empire who was in charge during Peter's ministry there. So, whether it be to the emperor as supreme, that is, as to the one being in authority. The Roman emperor at that time was, does anyone know? Nero, yes. Very violent and vicious man against believers, Nero. He was in power from 54 to 68. It was under Nero that Peter was martyred, as well as Paul. And he's the one who was the emperor at the time here that Peter writes. So, whether it be to the emperor as supreme, in other words, he is to be obeyed, unless, of course, he commands something which is contrary to the word of God. Then it's Peter says, goes on to say, or to governors as sent by him. We're looking into verse 14 now. Or to governors as sent by him. Literally, the Greek tells us sent through him. So the governors are sent through the emperor. Now, what does that mean? It means that the king, or the Roman Emperor Nero in Peter's case, appears here not as the source of the governor's authority. Now, how does that apply to us? Okay, our supreme leader in our country would be the prime minister, if I'm not mistaken. And then we have under him, we have the provincial, what are they called again? People like Doug Ford. Premiers, right? Yeah, so we have the premiers. Reminds me of the preacher that the Lord was humbling one time when he was preaching away, and he was preaching about Jonah, but he forgot Jonah's name. And as he was struggling for Jonah's name, he said, you know that guy that was swallowed by that big fish? Sometimes we can have a memory lapse like that. So the point that Peter is making here is that that the Nero in this case is not the source of the governor's authority, but as the channel by which the divine authority is conveyed to the governor. In Romans 13:1, which we read this morning, we read, "Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God." So the authority is given to civil authorities by God himself, and here in our passage we are told it's for two purposes. Negatively, Peter says, it's to punish those who do evil. That is, literally, it's for the punishment of those doing evil continually. They just go on doing evil after evil after evil. Now, in Romans 13:4, we read, "For he is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid. For he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is the servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer." Notice, he's carrying out not his own wrath, but God's wrath on the wrongdoer. The governor then executes God's wrath on the wrongdoer. Now, acting as an individual by taking personal vengeance on the wrongdoer is clearly forbidden in Scripture. We are not to take vengeance into our own hands, right? But we are to give way to God's wrath to be meted out by the proper authorities. In Romans 12:19, we read, "Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God, for it is written, 'Vengeance is mine, I will repay,' says the Lord." And that is a quote taken in Romans 12:19 from Deuteronomy 32:35. Now let me just pause for a moment here and remind you of an Old Testament situation that I think illustrates the point that Peter's making here, where the civil authorities are to punish the wrongdoer. I think we should take time to turn to the book of Esther together. In the book of Esther, in chapter 2 of Esther, near the end of the chapter, verses 21 to 23, Esther 2, 21 to 23, it says, "In those days, as Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus." Now, he's also known as King Xerxes, which you have in the NIV. "And this came to the knowledge of Mordecai, and he told it to Queen Esther." Remember that she was his relative, right? Queen Esther. "And Esther told the king in the name of Mordecai. When the affair was investigated and found to be so, the men were both hanged on the gallows. And it was recorded in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king." So here the king had these two conspirators hung on the gallows. He was punishing the wrongdoers in this case. But not only that, because this plot was brought to light by Mordecai, and Esther made clear that it was him who made known the plot, his name appears in the record that was written down about this event. And that's a very important point, as we're going to see a little bit later. Now, turn over to Esther chapter 7. What we're going to do next is we're going to go to Esther 6, first of all. Esther 6. Now, we're going to look at verses 1 to 11 here. Now, the king and Haman, you know, Haman was the arch enemy of the Jews, and he was plotting to have the entire nation annihilated if he could because of his hatred for Mordecai. Mordecai would not bow down to him because Mordecai said that should only be done to God. And Haman was demanding this kind of submission or reverence to him, and Mordecai refused. So Mordecai decided not to take vengeance not only on Mordecai, but upon his people, the Jewish people. Now, at this point, of course, as Mordecai had instructed Esther not to reveal her national background, so when the king married her, he didn't know that she was actually a Jewish lady. And so when Esther is aware of this plot to wipe out her people, she invites the king and Haman to a banquet. So they've already met the first time for a banquet. And when the king said, what is your request? She said, come back again tomorrow for another banquet. So they come back the second time for a banquet. However, before they came back the second time, chapter 6 tells us in verse 1, on that night the king could not sleep, and he gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written how Mordecai had told about Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold and who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus or King Xerxes. And the king said, what honor or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? You see, this is the positive side of what government is to do. They're to praise those who do well and who do good. The king's young men who attended him said, nothing has been done for him. And the king said, who is in the court? Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to speak to the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's young men told him, Haman is there standing in the court. And the king said, let him come in. So Haman came in, and the king said to him, what should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor? And Haman said to himself, whom would the king delight to honor more than me? And Haman said to the king, for the man whom the king delights to honor, let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn, and the horse that the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown is set, and let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. Let them dress the man whom the king delights to honor, and let them lead him on the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Then the king said to Haman, hurry, take the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so to Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Leave out nothing that you have mentioned. So Haman took the robes and the horse, and he dressed Mordecai, led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. So Peter tells us that one of the positive things that government is to do is to praise those who do good. And this is what King Xerxes was doing here. He was recognizing the good that Mordecai had done in protecting his life, exposing that plot, and he was now going to honor him publicly. So one thing we want to remember here is that the kind of praise for those who are doing good is based on moral behavior rather than economic status or political favoritism, right? Government often will praise those who have a high, wealthy economic position, or they are involved in the same political arena and show them favoritism. But that's not what the Bible tells us. It's the government is to praise those who act in the right way, who do what is right morally. And this is what Mordecai had done. You know, when you expose a plot of assassins, you could expose yourself to being assassinated yourself, right? It's a dangerous thing to expose this kind of a plot, but Mordecai did it, and God protected him through it. Now, this brings me to Esther 7 then, where we see another example of how the government authorities punish those who do evil. Take a look at Esther 7 now, verses 6 to 10. So they're at the banquet now, the second banquet, and when the king says to Esther, who is he, verse 5 actually, who is he and where is he who has dared to do this thing, that is, Esther, to destroy your people? And Esther said, verse 6, a foe and enemy, this wicked Haman. Then Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. Isn't that what Paul tells us in Romans 13? They are a terror to those who do evil. That's how it should be. Verse 7, and the king arose in his wrath from the wine drinking and went into the palace garden. But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm was determined against him by the king. And the king returned from the palace garden to the place where they were drinking wine, as Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. And the king said, will he even assault the queen in my presence, in my own house? As the word left the mouth of the king, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs in attendance on the king, said, moreover, the gallows that Haman has prepared for Mordecai, whose word saved the king, is standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high. And the king said, hang him on that. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the wrath of the king abated. So you see, one of the roles of the king and of governors is to punish those who do evil or who do wrong. Now, as we come to verse 15, we ask the question, how should we submit to kings and governors? Already in verse 13, Peter said, it is for the Lord's sake. We're doing it for the Lord's sake. He is the one who is requiring it of us. And the reason is because this is the will of God, verse 15 says, namely for those doing good to put to silence, that is, to muzzle. The actual word to put to silence there is refers to a muzzle that is put on a mouth so that the mouth, you know, when the ox is treading the grain, they are muzzled so that they keep on working and not spend all their time eating. To muzzle the ignorance of foolish men. False accusation by unbelievers is irrational slander, springing from the ignorance of those who are foolish people. Submission to human authorities is the specific kind of doing right that Peter is here talking about. So this specific kind of doing right by obeying the authorities over us is a means and a way of silencing the ignorance of foolish people who deliberately disobey and refuse to submit to those in authority over them. How should we submit in verse 16? Peter says we should submit as people who are free. Although the kind of freedom is not specified, the great freedoms of the Christian life are freedom from the impossible obligation to earn merit before God, Romans 4:5. Freedom from the guilt of sin in Galatians 3:13. And thirdly, freedom from the ruling power of sin. So we are free people, free in these specific areas. That's in Romans 6, 6 to 7. So we are to submit as free people. Negatively, we are not to use our freedom as a cover-up for evil. But positively, we are to use our freedom by living as servants of God. We owe our whole life to God. There is no such thing as absolute freedom for any person. True freedom is consistent with obedience to God's will. It results in the great joy of doing what is right. We either are going to serve sin or we're going to serve God. Remember that Paul viewed himself as a debtor to all men in his ministry. Now we come to the last verse, verse 17, and in rapid fire we now have four more commands. And it's because of what we have in verse 17 that the second part of my sermon title says, relating to all right? Submission, responding to civil authority, that is the king and the governors, but now relating to all. So what is Peter telling us here in verse 17? Let me just go back to that verse in my Bible here, 1 Peter, verse 17. Okay, says, honor everyone. Now that's how we are to relate to all. We are to honor everyone. We are to show respect to everyone. Everyone without exception that walks on this planet, doesn't matter who they are, what they've done, where they've been, you know, how they've messed up their life or whatever, we are still to respect them and honor them as made in the image of God. So that is how we are to relate to everyone. Then he says, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the emperor. Now the first command is, we say in the Greek it's aorist, it simply means that the command is given to do it. All right? Just do it. Honor everyone. The next three are ongoing responsibilities. So in the Greek, they're in the present tense, which means that they continue they're ongoing. So go on loving the brotherhood, go on fearing God, go on honoring the emperor. So here we have three specific groups referred to. We have the brotherhood, we have God, we have the emperor. So we'll just look at them briefly now. One of the writers, Grudem, argues convincingly that verse 17 has four commands and that the first is not simply a summary of the last three. He points out that the categories of believers, God, and the king, which are the last three categories that are found in the last three commands here, do not exhaust the all people in the first command of this verse, since unbelievers are omitted, and they are included in the all people. So such an omission would be very unusual in this context, where believers' relationships to unbelievers has been prominent already back in verse 12, as well as in verse 15 of this chapter. So the first one in is to honor everyone. This means everyone in the world, including unbelievers, since every person bears God's image, even though that image has been damaged by the fall into sin. We are to be courteous and respectful to all people. This command condemns much of man's treatment of his fellow human beings in the political, industrial, and educational world. But abuse within families and churches is also condemned. I have a book in my library written by a lady author entitled something like Sexual Abuse in Churches. Very revealing book of how church leaders and others in the church have been guilty of this very thing within that fellowship. So that kind of treatment, of course, is being condemned here by the way that we are to treat everyone with respect. Then Peter says, love the brotherhood. That is, go on loving the brotherhood. And of course, this is referring to the church. And we were reminded of that in our singing this morning, that we are to have a love one for another as brothers and sisters. Now, the higher obligation then to the brotherhood is not simply showing honor or respect, but it's having a deep agape love. The only other place in the New Testament where the Greek word for brotherhood is used is in 1 Peter 5:9. The context there refers to the brotherhood, that is the church, throughout the world, and how we are to deal with the arch enemy of Christ and his church, namely the devil. So to provide the context, I quote both verses, 1 Peter 5:8-9, where Peter says, "Be sober-minded, be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. Resist him, firm in your faith, knowing that the same kinds of suffering are being experienced by your brotherhood throughout the world." That is, by the Church of Christ. It's interesting that this word brotherhood is Peter's term for the church. He never uses the word church, actually, in his letters, but he uses the word brotherhood to refer to the church. Then the next command is to fear God. Again, is to go on fearing God, who is the king over the world and the church. A still higher obligation is here required because it includes respect, love, and fear. We are not to fear unbelievers in chapter 3:14, but we are to fear God. The last one is to honor the emperor, or honor the king, as the New King James says. The present command, again, stresses the continuing nature of the command, namely to go on honoring the king, that is, the world's political ruler. Now, with mild irony, Peter, by using the word honor here, as he did when he said honor all people, has the same word here, honor the king. In one sense, he puts the king on the same level as all the people. He uses the same command for them both. While having obligations to honor all people and the king, our obligations to God and the brotherhood are higher. And although the Roman emperor claimed to be divine, he was by no means equal to God. And yet, often the Roman emperor demanded worship, and when believers refused, they would pay the consequences for that refusal. And so I'd like to close with this thought. When civil authorities make demands on its citizens that are clearly contrary to the teaching of Scripture, then Scriptures must take a stand against submitting to such demands and face the consequences. In such cases, we must obey God rather than men, as Peter and the apostles declared in Acts 5 and 29. And you know, we're living in a climate in Canada where our freedoms are progressively being taken from us, and demands are being made upon us, even by civil authorities, whether it be in the political realm or the educational realm, that are making demands on us to do things that are clearly against Scripture and against our conscience. And so when we are very clear that it's a violation of what God has commanded, then we must be ready to take a stand and live with the consequences of what that might be. So may the Lord give us the grace as we continue our walk with Him in this world to please Him well as we relate to the authorities that are put over us, and as we relate to everyone in this world, no matter who they are. So may the Lord help us. Thank you.